Hello, if I haven't met you before, my name's Erin Glanville, lead pastor here at Artisan. I was at a conference this past week with other pastors, and as part of one of the roundtable conversations, we were asked to think together about what our neighborhood and wider community gives to us, what we as churches receive from our wider communities. And it was surprisingly hard, actually, for the pastors in these roundtables to come up with answers. I might come back to that in a couple weeks and tell you some of the funny ways we twisted the answers to be actually about what we end up giving. You know, like they offer us their need, they offer us the trust of their needs, etc. But anyways, it felt really relevant coming into this week where we're talking about this building, actually. And I think for me, the most obvious thing that we as a community receive from this neighborhood is this beautiful space and everything that it actually carries with it, which is much more than just this physical space. We're working on this series around place and about our relationship to place. And we began a couple weeks ago, Tim and I, by establishing a theological framework for place. We looked at the narrative arc of Scripture. Okay, so yeah, with this series, we started with this first movement of being rooted in place, the gift of being rooted in place, and what we receive from the places that we are in. And then the second movement of being uprooted, feeling like we don't have a place or don't have a home, whether that's because literally you've been displaced from your home country, being exiled, maybe being evicted from a home or a house, losing connection to your home, or I think maybe for many of us, losing a sense of connection to the faith that's rooted you in place. And we talked about how these realities invite us to practices of attentiveness, gratitude, lament, and humility, where we like find our role or our place within the place, you know? Don't think that we're kind of all the place is about. And then beginning last week, Scott had us thinking about concrete examples of places. So both the gift and the grief of specific places. Scott, Adria, Jobin, for those of you who were here, shared last week about the neighborhood that we gather in, that they live and work in. Today you're not going to get the usual sermon. Instead, we're honored to have two guests with us who are connected to the Japanese Hall. So Rika and Yoshi will be offering us their learning about the history of this building that we gather in and about the neighborhood that it's in. And in a moment, I'll invite them up, but I just wanted to say a few things first to frame that. I think we are I don't want to generalize or make us all one thing in the room, but I think that for many of us, we have or do deal with a sense of spiritual uprootedness, having either experienced religious trauma or growing convictions that required us to uproot and look for a new place to call home. And I think this is part of why when we gather here in this building, we come from all across the city and the lower mainland, and why it feels sometimes like a safe place, right? It's a sanctuary or a gathering place that we create here when we gather. And I think as a staff, we really hope that that's what it is, a place of rest and healing and growth and connection to Jesus. But if you remember the distinction between space and place that we talked about in the very beginning of this series, space becomes a place as it fills with relationships, as it becomes storied, as it becomes familiar. And so we sometimes talk about this as a space that we come into and we create place here with our relationships and our stories. But it would actually be kind of inaccurate if we were to think about this as a space, an empty space. Because this is actually a place. The Japanese language school, the Japanese hall where we meet, was a place long before Artisan was a thing. And it's full of relationships and stories during the other 6 days of the week. And so when we arrive and we gather here, we're entering into two things. We're entering into the current relational ecosystem that's here on this block and in this building. And we're also entering into the stories of its past. So it's what it stewards as a building. In other words, location isn't just geographic, it's also relational. Our location as a church is relational, and that looks different for all of us, and that's fine. But we impact every place we enter, every place we leave, which is neither good nor bad, it just is, right? But how we are in a place can contribute to neighborliness, or it can contribute to isolation and marginalization. And we want to be good neighbors. We're not always sure how to do it. I hear that a lot from folks. But our location as a church, in addition to putting us into relationship with the relationships here, is also putting us into relationship with stories and history. We're entering into the stories of this place when we gather here. Eli Wiesel, who's, I don't know if folks know of him, a Jewish philosopher wrote, or a storyteller, wrote, "The antidote to exilic dislocation is memory." Which is a lot of long words, but an antidote is something that counteracts or undoes the effects of poison. And exilic dislocation, it's just like that feeling of being uprooted and disconnected, not of your own choice, right? A sense of disconnection from your sense of home or place or general belonging. So memory, the stories of the past, are part, keeping that history alive, are part of the way we counteract or undo the feelings we have of not being at home here and now. It's not knowing who we are in a place. And so there's so much to this phrase, and I think we'll probably come back to it. But for now, I just want to offer these two things as reasons why I'm eager to hear Rika and Yoshi today, and maybe a frame for you too in listening, is I want to ask them about the histories and the stories of this place and this building, but also about the relationships that make this building and local area meaningful today. So we're going to hear from the two of them from each of their positions. So I want to welcome you to come now, and we'll chat. It's not working. Okay. All right. What's that? Sure. Maybe I'll just start by introducing these guys. We've got a lot of mic people. That's amazing. Now, if only that was reflected in our tech scheduling of volunteers. No. Okay. Welcome. So glad to have you here. I'm just going to very briefly introduce, and then if you want to say anything more about yourself, you're welcome to. So Rika is a board member on a number of local arts organizations in the neighborhood, and formerly worked for the Carnegie Community Center, and was formerly on the board of the Japanese Hall for 12 years, something like that. Yeah. So thank you for coming here, and we'll hear a little bit more too about you live here in the neighborhood for a long time. And Yoshi is the general manager here at the Japanese Hall and is somebody that we at staff at Artisan have a lot of interactions with just around the place and being in this building. So thank you so much for being here. Anything you want to add to who you are or?
Give me 2 hours.
Yeah, right. That's true. Yeah, not a fair question. Okay, so we've been meeting in this building for the last 8 years. Some of us have connection to the history of this building. Some of us have no connection to the history, and some of us just know about it, kind of like as an idea. So I was just wondering, Rika, if you could just start out by telling us a little bit about what you know about this building, its history, any stories that you'd like to tell us about the building.
Okay, so I will start, and Yoshi, you can add. So this building that you're in now was only built in year 2000. With what was the redress money. Redress was the redress for the internment of the Japanese Canadians during World War II. So prior to 2000, some funding, the redress was given by the federal government, and money was given to some local organizations. Vancouver Japanese Language School is one of the building organizations that received it. So this building was built. Prior to that, the adjoining building, that was built in 1928. That was where everything happened. All of this activity happened where the playground is now. When I first came to Vancouver, that was still the only place where the bazaars and everything happened in that small space back there, packed. So that was 1928. The original building was a few spaces down. And so the first Japanese language school was built in 1906. So in 1906, at that time, Japanese Canadian children went to school there. Their entire schooling was done in that school. And I guess a few years later, they started going to the regular Canadian schools and just started going to the language school after school and then on the weekends. So, and of course, like with any community organization, it wasn't just a school. It was where parents, everyone hung out. This was, the Powell Street was a Japanese neighborhood. Lots of shops, lots of restaurants. The trades were all here. Not everyone lived in this neighborhood, though. I think there's some impression that what we no longer call it Japantown, we call it the Powell Street area, was like a residential area. That's really not the case. Many people lived outside of, in Kitsilano, different places, but they would come here for the school. So that's really the history. And obviously during when the internment happened, everyone was moved out to various places in the interior. People went back to Japan. Some people moved all the way to the East Coast. And it wasn't until 1947 that Japanese Canadians were able to come back to the West Coast. And then it took another 5 years for the school to open again. And that was because this is the only, the next door building was the only building that was returned to the Japanese Canadians after the war. Everything else was taken, houses, farms, you know, shipping boats, everything was taken except this building. I don't know exactly what the reason is. It was like a government, it was kind of,
maintained the society status, so it wasn't the individual property, so it retained. And also the directors back then, they tirelessly worked together, dispersed in the different internment camps. They exchanged letters back and forth, and also they had a connection with a lawyer in Vancouver, and that lawyer represented the organization even during the internment time.
So from the different internment camps, they were communicating to try and kind of preserve this one building that they knew could be saved sort of for the community. Yeah.
Yeah, I would just really recommend if people are ever in, you know, in like the Nelson, Caslow, that area where all the internment camps were, there's some very interesting museums and even highway markers that talk about the history of the internment camps there. We have members of the language school who are very active in the whole, you know, commemorative aspects of it. So yeah, I would just recommend that if you don't know much about the history, you know, it's available to read. Yeah. All I want to say is that because this is the only building that was and right now, because this was a very vibrant Japanese community, the only two buildings that are left and still kind of used by the Japanese Canadians and Japanese are this school and the Buddhist church, which is right next to Oppenheimer Park. Yeah.
Right, yeah. Okay, thank you. I know that part of what the Japanese language school and the Japanese hall does is to sort of keep these stories and this history alive and commemorate them, but also bring them into now. And I'm curious, I remember going on the walking tour that you have. What's the name of that walking tour again?
Powell Street Historical Walking Tour.
Okay, all right. Which you do from time to time.
Yeah.
Folks could go on.
Yeah.
Just walking around and seeing the different properties that were taken from the community.
Yeah.
Yeah, and when I was on that tour, someone said, we as a community, we're not interested in returning this to an older, like to go back to calling it Japantown.
Right.
But we actually want to leave it the way it is and what it's called now because we don't want to displace the people who came here in the meantime.
Mm-hmm.
This is more of a communal space. And that says to me something about like your hope for what kind of presence you want to have here. And I was just wondering if you could say something about like who uses this building during the week,
right,
apart from us, and what kind of hopes do you have for how this building operates in this neighborhood?
Right. Because this building is used on Saturday, it functions as a Japanese language school. So the school is filled with children and families. They come and they learn the Japanese language and the culture. And during the week, we rent a space for this hall as well as a classroom for different organizations. And many of them are from downtown inside the communities. Some of them are, I wrote down the names. What are they? Oh, yeah, that's right. We have a Rain City Housing, ATIRA, and SRO Collaborative Community Land Trust, and there was the Powell Street Festival Society. And so many of them come here every week, and they hold the meetings and the workshops. And one example, the Vancouver Coastal Health runs a program called the Street Degrees. And basically, this is a workshop for the people to, for the training people for overdose prevention. And they, participants, some of them come from the encampment in the Crab Park. They come here each week and they learn how to save lives, and they get the certificate from the Coastal Health. And people like that, they come and use this space, and it's really great to see that the space is used and useful for the community. And so we know this downtown Eastside neighborhood is made of very diverse background of people. And it could be challenging time to time, like when we have a childcare space, we are running daycares Monday to Friday, and I hear the, you know, from the window, I hear the sounds of the children playing happily, and at the same time, I know there's a overdose prevention workshop, right? It's very different realities, and but that's what it is. And we know from the history, displacement and dislocation and disconnection and the Japanese-Canadian experience, I think the Japanese Canadian, we want to tell this story so that we don't repeat, and we don't want to impose the idea of ownership of the neighborhood by naming Japantown or claiming it, and that could that will have an impact on others that who are here and share their community.
Yeah, thank you. Jora, anything?
Yeah, I just want to add that when this building was built, yes, it started with some funding, redress money, but we also really needed to raise more funds to build it and to maintain it. And we took the opportunity of the 100th anniversary of the school, which was in 2008, to do some major fundraising. And one of the ways that we did that, and there was a lot of support. At that time, it was a good time for fundraising because downtown Eastside was a real focus for revitalization and so on and so forth. One of the things we did was use the older building as Yoshi said, a childcare center and a preschool. And then over time, a second childcare center was added, and I think it's part of the $10 childcare program. So it's, and one of the daycares is a Japanese immersion daycare, and one is a non-Japanese immersion. So we try to be as inclusive as possible of, you know, people in the neighborhood, and also you know, preserve the Japanese intent or the culture and the language. It's always a, you know, a balance.
Yeah, right? That's a tricky balance. Yeah, I can imagine. I think we there are ways that we could relate to that as well. I'm curious, you know, you've lived in the neighborhood for a very long time. How many years have you lived here?
I've lived in the neighborhood for about 14 years. Well, I lived in the East Side for 30 years.
30 years, uh-huh. Yeah. I'm just curious, across the years, what have you seen changing in this neighborhood?
Well, you know, I started working at the Carnegie Center, which is on Main and Hastings, in 30 years ago. It's always been a corner that had a lot of, you know, poverty and drugs and just marginalized people. And it's always been a place where, you know, I just always found it to be one of the most welcoming places. People are very generous and open. I remember when I first came here, I came from the States, and I had this highfalutin idea of coming here to do something for the people in the neighborhood. Well, that didn't last for very long, because really, people are just not into that kind of help. People are just really into have people being genuine with them, supporting them as they need to be supported. And I came in as an education programmer, an adult literacy worker, and just feel like, you know, that sense of what do you call it? You know, the sense of self and identity is very strong among the people. And they consider the community to be their place and place where they can actually tell people what to do. And I think that's great. They have ownership of the place. Over the years, I think it has really, it's been sad that so many really damaging drugs have come into the neighborhood. When I first came, it was heroin and, you know, downers, right? People were pretty mellow and, you know, and then crack, meth, all of those things have come in, and I think it has really changed the neighborhood. Also, poverty rates still, the you know, welfare rates is pitifully low. There's no housing, so there's so many different factors that affect, you know, the way the street looks. But I just feel like, you know, the more people are aware of all the different conditions that make this, you know, it's not just about the drugs, it's not just about the poverty. And also, you know, it's really about, you know, as you talk about, a place to have relations. So I know that, you know, working at the Carnegie, I always went with the thing that if you can give people just 15 minutes of time where they can get out of their situation, whether sitting and listening to music or just getting involved with some crafts or learning a few things in the learning center, you know, that 15 minutes is a huge thing. So, you know, it doesn't have to be anything big. It doesn't have to be anything really fancy and expensive. Just relate to people, communicate, provide safe places for people to gather and do their thing. So anyway, that kind of went off the thing.
Yeah, yeah. It's nice. So you you are working on the board of a number of arts organizations, and I know you really care about music spaces and art spaces, which is interesting because we have a lot of musicians and artists in our community as well as social workers, so a number of connections to what you're saying. What do you want to say about music and art spaces in this neighborhood? What have you seen, and like, what do you wish was there?
Well, they're declining, and they absolutely need to be saved, and more needs to come up, you know. And it's a very expensive city, I know, but I think it's crucial to have art space. And when we talk about music spaces and art space, we're not just talking so directly about just people playing music, you know. It just becomes a space for inclusive, you know, at least the organization I hope I'm working at, to include, to have partnerships with other organizations, to be more inclusive. And again, that element of both people being exposed to professional music and art, you know, which is, I think, is really important to get people to be inspired, but also having an opportunity to just, you know, experience creativity and expression. So yeah. I think that's really important.
Yeah, yeah, I remember in our conversation a few weeks ago, you said something about the worse the music is, the better. Something like that. We just,
well,
like,
that's at Carnegie Center.
Yeah, but like, because it's a space of like, we come in and be human together around these, yes, different artistic experiences and these expressions. Yeah, yeah. It's amazing. I'm wondering, does either of you want to answer this question? Just like, what do you celebrate about this neighborhood, either the way it is now or even just about this building?
I think, as you say before, that this place, including the neighborhood, it has different, many, many diverse kind of connections and relationships. And that's evident, and obviously it's easily witnessed on the Saturday Japanese Language School community. But whenever I have an interaction with the neighborhood members, they're a strong, tight-knit community here, and that's how I experienced. And I think that's not well, perhaps not well experienced or understood. And,
yeah. So you celebrate the tight-knit relationships among people in the neighborhood.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What do you think, Rick?
Yeah, I agree. I think I was saying to Aaron, when I first came on the board of the language school, it was getting a little isolated because, you know, this neighborhood was getting, from the perspective of the school, was getting worse, and they were starting to close their doors a bit. And because I worked at Carnegie, we took the 100th anniversary of the Carnegie Center as an opportunity to have a big community arts celebration. And one of the places where we actually celebrated was at the language school, because I thought this was the greatest place to have a community play. And so, so we were able to make that connection. We had like 6 months of the school being rented for rehearsals and costume design and so on and so forth. And there was a performance here for about 3 weeks. And that time, there were lots of people in the neighborhood came, and lots of people from outside of the neighborhood came. And one of the members, an indigenous man, always calls it the longhouse, the Japanese longhouse. And that kind of, you know, that kind of thing is, makes a huge difference. And I really commend, like, Yoshi for continuing to welcome, you know, downtown Eastside organizations and, you know, to just call this space their home. and I think that, that the more we can actually, and you know, the song, and I think the breaking down the walls is absolutely important. And I think it does, again, I think it doesn't have to be anything totally intentional and huge. As long as we have compassion in our hearts, and long as we are always in, you know, have that kind of humility in terms of where we are and acknowledge the lands that we are on, I think, you know, that's the main thing. Yeah,
thanks. I had a final question, which was, and I feel like you've sort of started to answer it, but just this question of what do you want to say to us as a community, you know, as outsiders to our community? What do you want to say to us? And you feel free to be, just, we just like to hear from you. Like, what do you see, what potential do you see for what we steward, and or just what do you want to say to us?
Well, thank you for inviting us today, and thank you for being a great neighbor. And I had to ask for forgiveness for many deficiencies that this building shares, and that's as Rika said, that both buildings are getting old and things are not working perfectly, and we run nonprofit organizations, so we don't always have every capacities and
So you're apologizing for the heat being off for a couple of weeks.
Yes, that's not working, and I'm glad that now sun is shining. Spring is here. So apologies, and I appreciate your understanding. And also, we need your help. So whenever, you know, you find the limitations of ours, let us know, and find a way to work together and to keep this building. And this building is, you know, designated as a heritage buildings by city, province, and also the federal designation, which means we have a responsibility to look after. And that's something that we can work together and other people who use this building and keep this building in place for the future generations. This building's gonna carry the story and history, and it's gonna be meaningful and important for the future Canadians and people in the community. And so we look forward to continue working together.
Yeah, thanks. I know one of the challenges that you have right now is the fobs, the places where we put in our numbers to get into the building get burned or are smashed pretty regularly, which is an expensive thing to replace every around a month or so.
Yeah.
So things like, practical things like that, if you see things in the building that need.
It is a reality being in this neighborhood. A couple of weeks ago, somebody just yanked off the door access device on the door, and we had to replace, and things disappear if doors kept open unattended. So that's something that we try to maintain some level of security so that we don't experience negatively. Then our community member will hold that will foster negative opinions about others, and which will impact our community relationships. So preventing those events will have that, not to hold that others negatively, but in negative views, but it is over in the bigger picture, it is important.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you. Rika, anything you want to say just about your vision for this building or?
Well, I just think it's great that all of you are here. I think not every one of you is from the neighborhood. So I think it's just the fact that you're here, I think it's great. And then take the word out of here in terms of how, it's nice to be in this neighborhood, and it's safer than people think, especially when you walk in it with a smiley face, people are pretty welcoming. Again, this organization has been built on volunteers. When I first came, there's very few, paid workers here. It really ran on volunteers. So if any of you ever run on Saturdays or when we have a big event, come and help out. And I think the school really values that volunteerism, the sense of giving to a place. And then, so there's that. And also the vision is that it continues to, I hope we can fix that window. But then it just continues to be a place where everyone feels comfortable, that is home, that they have some sense of ownership, that they can tell people like Yoshi what needs to happen. That it just be a community. Yeah.
What date is the Powell Street Festival this year?
It's always the first weekend of August, the BC Day weekend.
Okay, great. Yeah. So that's coming up.
The Saturday
that's something
and Sunday.
We cancel our services on that day so that we can be part of that and volunteer. Mm-hmm. So that'll be something you'll hear about.
Yeah, so you can either volunteer for the Powell Street Festival, which I'm doing, sorry, or volunteer for the language school because it's a huge fundraising and culture event. It's lots of fun.
Thank you so much for your hospitality in this building, and thank you for your care for this building and for stewarding the stories of it. And thank you this morning for its kindness to go away from your daily work and just come and be here, to talk about the things that we're interested in for us. So we really appreciate your time and
thank
that
you.
Too.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So for those of you who hadn't met Rika and Yoshi, this is just an opportunity to know a couple of faces now that are associated with the Japanese Hall. Thanks, you can head back. And also, I think even more hopefully this is a way of helping us to deepen our relationship, our sense of home in this place, our sense of belonging in this place, and our knowledge of the history and the relationships that impact when we gather here. And for those of us, which is the majority of us, who live and work elsewhere in the city, I think this is an invitation to get to know the stories and the people that make those places meaningful, right? If this isn't your primary place of belonging, what are the histories and the people that make those places meaningful?